A monk asked Yunmen, "When not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not?" Yunmen said, "Mount Sumeru. Mount Sumeru." Not producing a single thought, Mount Sumeru. Yunmen's gift of teaching is not stingy in intent. If you come with acceptance, he imparts with both hands. If you go on doubting, it's so high you can't get a hold. The blue ocean is wide, the white clouds are peaceful. Don't put so much as the tip of a hair in there. A phony cock crow can hardly fool me. I still won't agree to let you pass through the gate in confusion. I want to thank you all for coming here this morning and practicing this beautiful path of Zen. I hope you haven't been too uncomfortable. The heating system is still a work in progress. Last night it was about 75 degrees in here, no matter what we set the thermostat to, and today I think it's about 65 degrees, no matter what we set the thermostat to. So I'm sure they'll work it out. Or not, right? Or not. If you were uncomfortable this morning, I hope you went into deep mushin, deep, watch your breath very carefully, watch your breath, or call mu, and probably if you were really deeply concentrating, the temperature in the room ceased to be much of a problem. That's a wonderful secret of Zen practice. You know, earlier this morning, we had another problem that wasn't related to the temperature in the room. Apparently, there have been quite a few acts of... there have been some thefts in this building and on this campus, and some vandalism. And it's become quite a serious problem, so the campus police are trying to tighten up and make sure that doors aren't left open or windows are closed so that they can get a handle on some of this this problem. I know that this is a problem all over campus. In our building in Murray Hall, our chairman bought some lovely new carpets to go by the entryway. They're rubberized carpets, and when you come through the door, you might have muddy feet. They pick up all that dirt and mud, and basically it keeps things clean in the building. And they were actually very handsome. They were sort of a dark brown and really classy looking. And I admired them many times, but they're gone now. Somebody came in over the weekend and stole them. Right out of the, and they were, these are not small. These are probably 30 feet, maybe, I don't know, 30 feet long maybe, you know, 20 feet long anyway. So somebody came in and stole these, and we've had other break-ins. Somebody broke into our offices on the third floor. They broke through the door with probably crowbars and stole a video display unit. And so we've had quite a bit of thievery in that building. And so I understand why the police want to try to get a hold of things. This morning I came here at 6:30. And the first thing I do is to open this room up and make tea. I get the tea urn filled and get that started. And then I have a few little things I have to do in here to get things ready. And then I go upstairs to change my pants. And before I did that, I put the wedge in the door to hold the door open. And when I came down, to my surprise, a group of people were standing outside the building, and the wedge was gone. So I opened the door and let them in and put the wedge back. And then I did something, I can't remember, I had something to do, and I came back and the wedge was gone again. I thought, what the heck, you know? I know, I put it in there, you know? And this was, Kriti and Imtiaz put it back, and they noticed there was a policeman while I wasn't there. I think that was how things happened. And the policeman just said, I took the wedge out, and basically this is how it has to be. So when I heard about this, I said, well, where's the policeman? And I went out of the building because we had to keep those doors open because people come in all morning long, you know. So I ran after him and I said, officer, officer. And I said, you took the wedge out of the door? And he said, yes. And I said, well, we need to put it back. He said, well, I'll just take it out again. So his tone was a little, I don't know if I want to say, it wasn't belligerent. I interpreted it as belligerent, you know, and aggressive. And I myself was, you know, I got a little teed off, you know, because I thought he was being impolite and unpleasant. And I said, look, you know, we've been doing this for 12 years, and I know most of the police around here, and they've never bothered us at all about this. And he said, well, I'm not the police. He said, I'm campus security. And then I said, well, people come in and out. We need to have the door open. And he said, I'm sorry, I can't do that. You know. So anyway, finally we worked it out. You know, we talked, and I talked about the need to do this. And he called. He has a radio on his shoulder. And he called in, and then I had to make a phone call, and I talked to their central office to try to get them to open the door or get permission to leave it open. But the conversation was so interesting because, you know, I care a great deal about people practicing Zen. I'm always very happy to see everybody here on a Saturday morning. And I guess I don't have to tell you that Zen practice means a lot to me. It's helped me enormously in my life. And I really can't repay the people who taught me this path. I must say I could never thank Genki Roshi and Webb Roshi enough for helping me, because when I started doing this, I wasn't a very happy person, and it's really transformed my life. And I myself didn't really want to teach Zen. That was really not something I never actually particularly wanted to do. I didn't want to be in pain, and I really just wanted to wake up. And even after I had been practicing for a long time, and even after I had received authorization to teach, I really wasn't just something I wanted to do. But after about 8 years, I decided that I should try to help other people, that it wasn't particularly, I wasn't really doing my best to be a good person if I wasn't trying to help other people, since this had helped me so much. So anyway, the point is that I have tried to take very seriously my job, so to speak, as a sensei, you know. And I've tried to take it seriously and do a good job. And so I have a personal investment in my relationship with people here. And I also have like a, what I think of as like a moral responsibility to you know, do what my teachers told me to do, which is to teach. And on an occasion like that, when the door is not opened and people can't get in, this is like a archetype, right? You know, if you're a Zen teacher, this is like an archetype. People want to come in, but they can't come in. You know? So there's a barrier, right? These are the people who want to be here, and they can't get in. You know? This is, if you're a Zen teacher, this is like a bad dream, right? You know? Okay. So it's a kind of archetypal moment, right? It would be like throwing somebody a rope and somebody else is cutting the rope as you're throwing it. You know? So it's kind of frustrating. And I was a little bit, pissed off, as we say, you know, because this is getting in the way of something I want to accomplish that I feel is important and necessary and beneficial. And so, you know, when this policeman, or this, I should say, security officer, he seemed to be giving me a hard time. You know, he didn't seem to be very polite. He wasn't, you know, very helpful. It was just like, well, if you put it back, I'll take it out again. It's like, huh? No. I began to get angry. And, at some point in the conversation, something turned around in my heart. And I don't exactly know where it was, but I think it was where he said, I'm not a policeman, I'm a campus security, you know. Things happen so fast, we don't really know why we do the things we do. But at some moment in that conversation, my fear about the uncontrollable situation, my anxiety about people not being able to get in, and my anger at being thwarted or blocked, all sort of disappeared. And I felt the kind of like a compassion or connection with this guy. Because at some point, you know, I looked him in, I could, his name was Officer Zink, I think it was. Officer Zink. And I suddenly stopped being mad at him, and I felt this compassion for him. And I think, I don't know what did it exactly, but I think it had to do with that, where he said, I'm not a policeman, we're campus security. I actually felt very moved by that, because, you know, the campus police don't like to be called campus police. And you might say, well, why not? What's wrong with it? They want to be called campus security because they don't want to see themselves as like little dictators who go around and tell everybody what to do. They want to see themselves as our protectors. See? And what he was trying to do was to protect us. Right? So he's going all over the campus checking the doors to protect everybody. So he's doing just what I'm doing, right? He's trying to do his job, his ethical, moral, existential job, right? And I'm getting in his way, right? You know, because I keep putting this darn wedge in the door and letting the bad guys into the building, right? And when I sat on the cushion, you know, and so... So at the end, it worked out okay. You know, it didn't come. There wasn't like a lot of hostility, and all this happened just like in a few split seconds. But I could see myself, I could see my mind, you know, getting mad. And then I could, you know, see this anger dissipating and this sense of, like, you know, love or connection to this guy. And I think what did it was his saying, campus security. I'm not a policeman, I'm campus security. And at the end, he was very helpful. His job was no wedges in the door. And he finally said, look, you know, you call up and try to work it out, and I'll just leave you alone, right? You know, in other words, he was ambivalent. He saw my side, or he saw my situation, and he didn't, his own situation, his own job said, you have to do this, no wedges in the door. But he suddenly understood what I was up to, you know, and I understood what he was up to, which is to be our protector. Now, when I was sitting on the cushion here this morning, I was thinking about all of this because, you know, particularly because my father was a naval officer, but he was, his particular area in his later life was naval security. See, my father was a security officer, you know. And he was often in charge of security on naval bases. That was his specialty. So, for example, when we were at the Naval Weapons Station, he was in charge of Naval Weapons Station security. And same thing in the Bangor complex out in Washington State. My father was the guy who was in charge of all the military police who patrolled the perimeters and, you know, inspected the fences and things like that. That was his job. So this guy was kind of like my, it was like looking at the face of, it didn't seem to me, and I didn't think this at the time, but as I was sitting here on the cushion, I was thinking, this guy's a little bit like my father. You know, this I could have been having a conversation with my father or an altercation with my father this morning. And I found myself very moved by that. You know. It's difficult to avoid these kinds of clashes in life, you know. And it's not hard to see how they can escalate, right? You know, if things had gone a little differently, things could have gotten, you know, very heated, right? I mean, if he had been really rude to me, that might have escalated things. And under other circumstances, I might have behaved differently, too. I'd like to think that the reason I had that experience was my Zen practice. You know, I often get questions from people, and they'll ask, you know, how can I change my life? How can I be a better person? How can I transform my consciousness? And often I think what they want me to say is, you know, start doing this, you know, in your life. When you're drinking a cup of coffee, try to be mindful. As you're going through your daily activities, try to be kind, you know, and so on. If somebody asks you for one lump of sugar, give him two. But actually, I think those are all very artificial. You know, earlier in my life, I was a fairly unhappy person, and I also think very I think I had a short fuse, to tell you the truth. I think earlier in my life I had kind of a short fuse. And it bothered me very much if I lost my temper or I became angry. But, you know, when I would, you can't make yourself not be an angry person, actually. You know, it's true. You can say, don't be angry, you know, but it doesn't work like that, you know. Somebody If somebody's rude to you on the street, you know, you're suddenly, you flash with anger. You know, somebody, you know, insults you, you suddenly explode with anger, right? This is how, and so your response has like deep roots in your relationship to the world. Deep roots. And you're not going to be able to change yourself if you simply try to make an intellectual decision to be a better person. I won't get angry. I won't get angry. I won't. It's just not going to work. Because you're caught up in the flow of events, right? And then somebody does something to you that you say is like an injury. Like an injury. And usually we get mad when we're injured. You know, most anger is like righteous anger. Right? Most anger is really like righteous anger. And so we usually get mad when we feel we have a right to be mad, right? On some level, it may not be something we think about, but we feel like I have a right to be angry here. Yeah. And so, you know, it's just not something we make a decision about. It explodes on the scene there's a kind of feeling of righteousness or correctness about this. You know, only later do we realize, you know, geez, what an ass I was. You know, why did I do that? And that was so over the top and so on. So I actually had this problem to some degree when I was younger. And I don't think I have it to the same degree anymore. I don't go around trying to police myself so much. And I think what did it was just sitting on the cushion. You know, just lots of zazen, lots of zazen. It's not hard to see that this is a big problem all over the world, you know, all over the world. This kind of anger problem, or these kinds of conflicts escalate so quickly, and they're very deeply rooted in human behavior. I mean, look, this is just an ordinary day on a college campus, right? You know, here's a security officer doing his job. Here's somebody trying to do something in the Zen Sangha, Zen community. We're both just going about our business, and you know, bump up against each other. And in other circumstances, it could have gotten messy. You might have been reading in the newspaper, or you might have heard on the radio about this incident in New York where this poor guy was the target of some kind of a stakeout in a club in New York. And he was in his car, and he was trying to get out of a parking lot while the police were closing in on him. And as he was driving, he hit one of the officers and knocked him, knocked him down or something. And the police just filled the car full of bullets. And when an incident like this happens, you know, it's so obviously terrible, right? I mean, it turns out the person didn't even have a gun, right? Had never fired a shot, and so on. And the response is so disproportionate that it's appalling. But you know, if you begin to look at human interactions, they're highly charged with these kinds of tensions. And when they reach that explosive level, it's distressing for everybody, but so often this goes on. So often this goes on. I'm surprised sometimes by how vehement people can be and how aggressive they can be, you know. I was reading, I don't know if any of you subscribe to Salon.com, But it's an online magazine that I sometimes read. I'm a subscriber. And in the magazine, they had had an article, an interview with a Buddhist scholar whose name is Alan Wallace. And Alan Wallace is somebody who's involved in brain research and meditation. So he trained in Dharamsala to be a geshe, a Tibetan teacher, a senior Tibetan teacher. And he spent many, many years in Dharamsala. He learned Tibetan, and for a number of years he was the translator for the Dalai Lama. And he actually, in Tibetan Buddhism, they actually have like degrees, like a PhD. The Geshe degree is like the highest degree. We don't have any degrees in Zen, but they do in the Tibetan tradition. And so Mr. Wallace had gotten a Geshe degree. And then he came back to the United States and he got a degree in some kind of biology related to the brain. And he's written quite a few books. He's one of these very, very bright people who just cranks out a book every 2 years, and they're pretty good books. So they had an article in the Salon, sort of an interview with him. And I read a piece of the article, and then I had to go to a meeting. And then I came back and I went back to the magazine after the meeting, and I wanted to see some of the letters. So after they publish things in Salon.com, there's opportunity for readers to respond. And the letters were just awful. I mean, they were unbelievably hostile. And they were vulgar. You know, a few of them were nice, but a fair number were just like, absolutely hostile. And I was so surprised. I thought, you know, I actually kind of liked the article. You know, people were upset because they said, you know, Buddhism has nothing to do with science, you know, and the Buddhism is a fraud, blah, blah, blah. Science is a fraud, you know. Why are you, you know, pandering to science, you know? There are some people from the Zen community saying, oh, Tibetan Buddhism stinks, you know, Zen is the only way, you know, and it was amazing, right? And there were some very unpleasant letters about the Dalai Lama, you know, this guy's just sat on his ass all his life, what's he ever done for mankind, and this kind of stuff, really amazing, you know, this hostility. And, you don't have to look in Salon, the letter column of Salon.com. You know, we can look at what's happening in Iraq, all over the world. You know, we want to have an optimistic view of ourselves, right? We want to say basically, you know, everything's okay. We're all, I'm okay, you're okay, you know. And it's just not that simple, is it? You know, because really, in our interactions, the flashpoints are very, very close to the surface all the time. You know, that moment where things could escalate into hostility, it's not far from very many of us, I think. And it's unrealistic to think of humans as basically A-okay. You know, I really think that's an unrealistic assessment given the state of the world. I mean, it's true that people are capable of extraordinary compassion and generosity, and in fact, people are fundamentally compassionate, but they get very confused. And violence is very much part of our world. It's part of, if you watch television, it's part of our entertainment, it's part of our... And it's very difficult to correct. Very difficult to correct, because you can't just make it. You can't just say, "Oh, I won't be violent. I won't be angry. I won't be fearful." You can't just command yourself. And the other thing about this sort of aggression in human beings, or this anger in human beings, is that it is often tied in with a kind of sense of rightness or self-justification, you know, which makes it very hard to correct. When 9/11 happened, Americans just were appalled, of course, you know, that this had, we'd been attacked, and you know, there was this tremendous sense of injustice of this. And the nation went into like a collective experience of consoling itself and so on. There was an article in the newspaper that very few people noticed, very few people read, but I noticed it because it was by Thich Nhat Hanh, a very famous Vietnamese Zen teacher. And they had asked him, as somebody who lived through the Vietnam War, to comment on 9/11. And his comments were very judicious, very carefully phrased. But he said, you know, I will never forget, you know, when the, he did, I don't think he said the Americans, but I think he just said, I will never forget when my village was, when napalm was dropped on my village. You know, I remember how terribly painful that was and difficult to deal with. And he was making a point, really, that maybe the reporter didn't want to pay attention to, and that, but he was kind of saying, you know, in the case of 9/11, you're not entirely innocent. You're not completely an innocent victim. And of course, if you had said that in public, you could have gotten beaten up, right? You know, because, you know, we were pretty much seeing ourselves as innocent victims. And I think this is something all human beings do all the time. You know, I think we all do this all the time. I was amazed the other day. I was reading something in the paper about Saddam Hussein, and it actually said that Saddam Hussein, he still believes on some level that the people of Iraq are going to go, Saddam, we were so wrong about you. You're the only guy who can run the country, you know? Please come back and take over, right? It was incredible, right? It's like, this can't be. But, you know, when we do anything, we always tell the story in such a way, generally speaking, I shouldn't say always. We always tell the story to make ourselves the hero, right? So whenever, you know, as we go through our lives, we're always telling the story to make ourselves the hero. So when we are trying to explain what we do, you know, what we do, we often, we put the best spin on our actions, you know, put the best spin on our actions. I even think people like Stalin and Hitler might have seen themselves as victims of history, you know, really and truly. Like, this is the thanks I get for trying to save Russia, you know, this is the thanks. I think we all, I hope I'm not downing you out, but I think we all tend to do this. It's very hard not to write our own stories or tell our own stories as we're living them in such a way that we make it all, we make our own motives and our own desires good, and, you know, divide things into good guys and bad guys. You know, this is very human. And it's not something we consciously do, it's like deep habit. Now, you know, people don't know this, but Bodhidharma, the person who brought Zen to China, is famous for sitting in front of a wall for 9 years. He's famous for having an interview with Emperor Wu of Liang and not managing to connect with the emperor. He's famous for starting the Shaolin Temple. He's famous for starting martial arts at Shaolin Temple, which I don't believe he really did, but he's supposed to have. He's famous for bringing tea to China, which he probably didn't do. You know, he's not so famous for, and he's famous for some writings that he did on emptiness. But he also wrote a very interesting, little verses on requiting injury or responding to injury. And after 9/11, I was asked by a reporter to give him the Buddhist view on dealing with injuries. And I got a translation of his verses on requiting injury, Bodhidharma's verses, and they weren't very well translated, and they weren't very graceful. So I cleaned them all up. I spent an hour, got it in good shape, and I sent it off, and it never made it into print. And I understand why, because what Bodhidharma said was something that might be disturbing after 9/11. What he basically said was, you know, whenever we're injured, whenever people hurt us, we have to realize that whenever people hurt us, whenever people injure us, it would be good if we understood it as a way of working through our own prior karma, our own prior mistakes. In our past lives, you know, if you, basically Bodhidharma said, if you knock around the universe long enough in one form or another, you're pretty much going to have done every bad thing that it's possible to have done. You know, probably, if you want to put it that way, you've been a killer, you've been a Hitler, you've been a Saddam, you've been a thief, etc., etc., you know. Probably so, if you want to think of it that way. So, you know, we all have a lot to clean up, a lot of karmic debt to clean up. And when somebody hurts us or does us an injury, it would be a good idea if we understood that we're cleaning up our own karmic baggage. That this is something we had to go through to make up for something we did in the past, something we might not even remember. And that we need to see the people who injure us as they're like our best friends. They're helping us to do something that is absolutely necessary. That they may be trying to hurt us, but actually they're serving our best interest. They're our best helpers. They're doing us an incalculable kind deed, and we should be incredibly happy, and we should actually hope for their happiness. See, that's really what the verses say. When people do us an injury, we should realize that it's probably in some way something we have to work through in order to be better people. It's like a debt we have to pay. And that these people who are hurting us are really helping us. And that we should wish them happiness in life. See? And I just think that's wonderful teaching. And I don't think you can say, okay, this is how I'm going to approach things now. I think that insight comes to you if you practice long enough. You know, if you want to, how do you become a better person? I think you sit on the cushion, you straighten your back, you watch your breath, and you call mu, right? Or you work with your koan. And little by little, you know, you become less afraid of the world and less afraid of being a failure. Less afraid of disappointing all the people in your life whom you didn't want to disappoint. Less And I think when the fear goes away, you know, the anger goes away. I generally think that anger has its roots in fear. And when the fear goes away, the anger goes away. And when the anger goes away, it's like compassion arises spontaneously in your heart. So I think this is like a process we go through in our practice. You know, it's you sit on the cushion and you encounter all of these inner obstacles, and you work through them again and again and again and again. You know, every time you sit, you're going through this process, right? You sit on the cushion. Maybe you came in here today and you said, okay, I'm going to have a wonderful sit. The first thing that happened to you was that you began to feel really cold, right? And you think, why am I, this is not what I want. I don't want to be cold, I want to be warm. Yeah. When it's warm, I can have a good sit, you know? But I can't have a good sit when I'm cold. I can't get my mind off this cold, you know? So you breathe out, and there's the cold, right? You breathe out, and there's the cold. You breathe out, and you say, I hate this, I hate this. And at some point, you might have just said, oh, it's okay. You know, it's okay. And you might even begin to feel happy, even though it's cold, right? And when that has happened, it's a wonderful, it's a real triumph, right? It's a real triumph. I didn't like this, and now I'm happy, you know? That's the essence of Zen, right? I didn't like this, and now it's okay, and I'm happy, you know? This is what happens every time we sit on, you sit on the cushion and your knee hurts and you think, oh, this is not what I wanted. You know, I planned to come here today, sit on the cushion, enter bliss, you know, and later I'll get up and my heart will be full of love and everything will be wonderful. You sit on the cushion and your knee bothers you and it bothers you and it bothers you. You think, oh, damn it, you know, this is not my dream. I hate this, I hate this. You know, if you could kill the pain in your leg, see, I mean, maybe when Bodhidharma says, we've been murderers and so on, you think, oh, I haven't been a murderer. That's nonsense. Well, maybe not. You know, I mean, I don't know about you, but I think when I was 13, there were a lot of people I wanted to kill, you know, including my parents. And I'm glad I didn't, you know, because I love them. But that desire, you know, that maybe you were different, but that desire was really there sometime, right? Just a real anger, you know. Maybe you were different. But, you know, I think most people, if they're honest, and I could be wrong, you know, could be me, but most people, if they're honest, I think have been really mad, you know, I could just kill him, right? You know? We don't carry it out, but the desire, you know, that level of anger could be there, you know, sometimes. And that's one way of, you know, we all have that anger somewhere in there because it comes out of fear, you know, fear, basically, I think. And another way to think about what Bodhidharma says is this, you know, I'm really not separate from anybody else. You know, that's an illusion. And, you know, if you take away that illusion, you realize, you know, these people that are so bad are really part of myself. You know, we're all like one big life. You know, you can look at Hitler and say, not me, brother. But, you know, in a very real sense, yes, it's me. You know, there's a Hitler in me. And Hitler, in a certain sense, was me. You know, is me. You know, it's all one life. It's all one big life. And in that life, there's a lot of bad things. And you know, one way to look at it is to say, well, I'm separate from that. I'm different from that. You know? But the Zen approach is to constantly take away that sense of separateness, that barrier. And again and again, you know, you want to be separate from the pain in your leg. You want to be separate from the cold. You want to be separate from whatever's bothering you, including this this annoying security officer, right, who is taking the wedges out of the door. And basically, you know, at some point, you just realize this is my true self. You know, I'm looking into the face of my father. I'm looking into my own face, you know. And at that point, you know, fear subsides, and it's possible to have another kind of emotion. It doesn't mean you approve of people who do bad things. It's possible to understand if you see people who have done bad things not as evil, but as people who have been defeated by life. I think that's a big plus, don't you? I really don't believe in evil, and maybe that's terribly naive, but when I see these people who do such terrible things, I think they've been defeated in life. They haven't managed to overcome these things. They're desperate, defeated people. And it's possible to have contempt for such people, but I myself have been desperate and defeated. And maybe again, you know. So that's my true self too, you know. My second teacher, Webb Roshi, was a courier for the Dalai Lama. In our Dharma lineage, you notice that we mention some Tibetan teachers. And Webb was very close to a number of Tibetan teachers also. He really got around, you know. He's an amazing guy. And he used to take tour groups from China into Tibet. This was when, in the summers, when I was training at the Seattle Zen Center. He used to take, he'd go to China, and he would take American tourists to China and go to the temples and tell them about the art and so on. And then he'd go to Tibet, and he used to take, secret messages, so to speak, from the Tibetan community out in exile to people in Tibet proper. So he was helping to maintain communications between people in Tibet and people in Dharamsala and so on. And he got to know a man whose name escapes me right now, but he was the abbot of the Ganden Monastery. If you go out on the website, if you go out to Google and you type in Ganden, G-A-D-E-N, Ganden is like a Buddha paradise, is what Ganden means, like Sukhavati, or paradise. It was the biggest monastery in the world at one time. And basically, during the Red Guard period, the Red Guards went in and killed a lot of the monks. And the abbot was hung up by his arms for a number of years, literally. And every once in a while, they'd come and hose him down, you know, so he would clean him off so he wouldn't smell so bad. And I guess they hauled him down and fed him so he didn't die. But Webb knew him quite well. And, Glenn said that this was somebody who, he saw this as his practice. You know, he saw this whole experience as his challenge or his practice. And that when anger arose in his heart, he didn't blame his tormentors. He saw it as a defect in himself. Yeah? So it really wasn't about his tormentors. It was about becoming Buddha, right? It's not about my tormentors. It's about my own failing to be compassionate. And that's the problem. See? They're not evil. That's not the problem. They're defeated and desperate people. The real failure here is my failure to be adequately that's how he saw it. That's how that was very moving when I heard about that. I always admire the novel devices of Yunmen, Cloudgate, All his life, he pulled out nails and wedges for people. He was always trying to help people. Why did he sometimes open the door and set out a bowl of glue? In other words, he was always trying to help people, but sometimes what he'd do is put a bowl of glue on the other side of the door so you'd open the door and step into the bowl of glue. Or dig a pitfall in the middle of the road. He'd dig a big hole in the middle of the road. Why did he do that anyway? Right? Those are the kinds of things that piss you off in life, right? Okay. Try to discern. A monk asked Yunmen, when not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not? Yunmen said, Mount Sumeru. Mount Sumeru. This is our practice again and again. You know, we encounter something we don't want, we don't like, we hate. I hate this pain in my legs, I hate this cold, you know, but whatever. And I hate it, and then suddenly, you know, your heart opens up, love arises, and it's this sense of connection to everything around. Just, I love this life. I love this cold. I love this pain. I love this pain. I love this security officer. I looked into the face of my own father this morning. You know, this afternoon I'm going to write a little letter to the rector, and I'm going to thank him so much for being. I am. I swear. I mean, I have to do it. You know, and because. I want to thank him for the kindness he showed me, you know, and I'm so grateful for that kindness. Somewhere in everybody there's kindness. And at the end of his conversation, he was solicitous of me. You know, his duty said, do this. And at the end, he was trying to think about how he could help me do what I needed to do. So I think in the course of our exchange, we went from bumping into each other to trying to help each other. You know, what good luck that was. You know. Not producing a single thought, Mount Sumeru. Yunmen's gift of teaching is not stingy in intent. If you come with acceptance, he imparts with both hands. You go on doubting, it's so high you can't get a hold. The blue ocean is wide, white clouds are peaceful. Don't put so much as the tip of a hair in there. A phony cock crow can hardly fool me. I still won't agree to let you pass through the gate in the confusion. I wonder if you could just be seated for just a second. Would that be all right? And would you always come in, if you don't mind, would you be kind enough to turn your sutra book to the Heart Sutra?